Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has 2 limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History Hit. It's the anniversary of the Nuremberg trials this year, 75th anniversary. They were held in autumn, in fall 1945. A remarkable departure from past practice. Leaders, military and political, of the Nazi regime were brought together and tried for war crimes by the victors. Standard accounts of these trials tend to gloss over the fact that the Soviets were fully involved alongside the British, the French, and the Americans. And Francine Hirsch has written a brilliant new book, Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, showing how the Soviets were both responsible for the trials existing in the form they did, but also how they shaped the course and judgments in those cases. It shows that it's a really fascinating story, which shows how the fissures of the Cold War opening up before the gun barrels of the armies in Europe are even cold. If you want to watch all the documentaries we've produced for the 75th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, please go to History Hit TV. We've got hundreds of documentaries there, hundreds and hundreds of podcasts. It's a one-stop shop for all your history needs. Please go over there and use the code POD1 at checkout, POD1, and you will get 1 month for free, and then you'll get your second month for just £1, euro, or dollar. Please go and check it out. In the meantime, everyone, here is the excellent Francine Hirsch. Fran, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. It's a real thrill to be here.
Very embarrassingly, I did not realize the Soviets had anything to do with Nuremberg. But I thought it was the Western Allies prosecuting the German, the Nazi operatives that they particularly had a beef with. So tell me, what was the Soviet involvement?
That's really kind of funny. I mean, sometimes when I say that people don't realize that or don't know that, I'm like, am I overstating that? But the more people I talk to, the more people say that they really didn't know that part of the story. And the Soviets had a fundamental role. They were one of the 4 countries of the prosecution, along with the United States, Britain, and France. Being part of the prosecution meant that they were part of the tribunal that were judging the Nazis as well, because the 4 countries did both. And not only that, not only did they have a fundamental role in the trials, but as I argue in the book, I don't think the Nuremberg trials would have happened without the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was out in front during the darkest days of the war, really pushing for a special international tribunal to try the Nazi leaders. And at that point, early on, the Western powers, well, at that point, France is defeated, but Britain and the United States are very resistant to this idea, in part because the war is still going on and they're concerned about retaliation, but in part because there's this idea that can you really try the leaders of a state for committing crimes, and for what the Soviets were actually starting to argue was that they should be tried not just for war crimes, but for what they were talking about then is the crime of waging an aggressive war. And one of the Soviet jurists, a guy by the name of Aron Trianon, was really out in front there as well, arguing that the crime of a crime against peace waging an aggressive war should be criminally prosecuted as well. And so that became a really fundamental part of the legal framework of the Nuremberg trials too. And I think it's really interesting that in a lot of this kind of the books in the US that I've read about this early on, and this is starting to change, but especially when I first started working on this project, people talked about the US as coming up with this idea of crimes against peace with Murray Bernays in the War Department. And in fact, lots of people were talking about aggressive war, but crimes against peace, we kind of, I was able to trace the paper trail of seeing how Trianon's ideas made it to London, to the meetings of the United Nations War Crimes Commission, and then made it across the Atlantic to the War Department and to the White House as well.
It's so interesting that it was a Soviet idea. Is that because there was a period of the war when the Soviets thought, you know what, the Allies might reach Berlin first and they might just let all these guys off the hook? You know, so I wonder if did the Soviets grow, I guess, when it turned out actually they were the ones who captured Berlin and made the first serious inroads into the Reich, they must have been tempted to kind of dispense with the Western allies and just hold these trials themselves. I mean, did the Soviet relationship with the trials change depending on the course of the war?
Yeah, they always wanted a four-power tribunal or a three-power tribunal early on, and France is brought in. And when they're calling early on in October 1942 for a special international tribunal, the war is still going on. Victory, it's a dream, right? No one knows what's going to happen with the war at that point. But part of what prompts them to talk about this is the Soviet Union has already been so devastated by the war, right? In ways that it's hard for Americans, I think, to really understand. Just the lives lost, the amount of devastation that's been done. And so they're thinking already about reparations. And they're thinking about ways to make a claim for reparations. And they understand that in order to make that claim, it would be helpful to have this tribunal. The Soviets, of course, also have different ideas about what a war crimes trial might look like. And when they're talking about a special international tribunal, they're imagining something that's going to be pretty quick, open and shut. So what happens later as the war is kind of coming towards an end, there's still talk and there's still resistance from the British in particular, actually, who are calling for more of an executive degree to deal with the most heinous leaders and the most heinous crimes, right? And because they say that, how can you try like Hitler? How can you try Goering? And the Soviets are really at that point still pushing for that. And another reason that the Soviets want this to be an allied venture is at the end of the war afterwards, once everyone gets to Berlin and all of that, is because some of the major war criminals, the most major ones, have been captured by the Americans and the British. And so they want to be right in on that too. They want to be part of this four power alliance later at the table of victors in order to, and again, they think it's going to be quick, open and shut. Everything that happens, like once they get to Nuremberg, even a lot of what happens once they get to London in June and then have the London Agreement in August, a lot of that, it comes as a surprise to them as well.
So there's an irony here in this story that the great, you know, the illiberal authoritarian USSR helps to kind of establish this precedent of this kind of post-war international settlement, this precedent of transnational legal bodies and which echoes down to the present day.
Absolutely. I mean, that to me is the heart of the story. That to me is the heart of the story, that we have this Nuremberg myth still, that the Nuremberg trials were all about liberal Western leadership. It was all about the rule of law. We get this beautiful, glorious story of the leadership of Robert H. Jackson and the leadership of the Americans and the British and all of this. And the fact that the Soviets, again, Stalin's Soviet Union, had a fundamental role in putting together the legal framework of the trials, in carrying out the trials, and then later on in deliberations about international law as well. I think that's a really crucial part of the story. And I think it's critical for a number of reasons. You know, we, in idealizing Nuremberg, I don't think we're doing ourselves a favor. You know, still in some conferences that I've been going to and kind of attending virtually recently, when people talk about the Nuremberg trials, there's a tendency on the one hand to either hold it up as this as a triumph of the rule of law, or to denounce it as victor's justice, right? And both of those are oversimplifications that you kind of avoid the messiness, right? The politics that are all in the middle of it. And I think we need to understand that messiness. We need to understand what happened. We need to understand the compromises that were made by all of the countries at the table. And I actually find it kind of reassuring in this time that we're living in now to know that the messiness and the politics and, you know, the Cold War politics, I mean, all of it, that in the middle of that great big mess, you could still come out with these ideals, right? These ideals that carry forth. And even, you know, no matter what you think about international law and how useful it is, this or that, that's a whole nother debate. I think that what happens afterwards in the Soviet Union and in other states, these ideals provide something for even for dissidents to grab onto and to argue for rights. And I think it's important. I think it's just important to know that it's not this, you know, beautiful myth that we can wrap up, but that the complexity is what I like about the story.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that complexity and how it played out in the trial itself. I mean, how did Soviet involvement, not that I'm claiming the Anglo-Saxon nations, the British and Americans and French were all paradigms of judicial propriety, but how did the Soviet involvement make itself felt as these trials were underway?
Well, in a bunch of different kinds of ways. I mean, first of all, I want to say that the Soviets contributed positively to the trials as well, right? Through their witness testimony, through the collection of the evidence, through the footage that Soviet filmmakers had shot during the war. So in the way that they were able to chronicle the war and the atrocities and contribute to the historical record in that way, that's very positive, right? At the same time, the Soviets go in really thinking that it's going to be an open and shut case. They go in, they have this history of show trials, the Stalinist show trials of the 1930s, all of the members of the Soviet delegation that are sent to Nuremberg, the Soviet chief judge, Yona Nikitchenko, the Soviet chief prosecutor, Roman Rudenko, the assistant prosecutors, they all had played major roles in the show trials. And so that's a piece of this too. And because the Soviets think that it's going to be open and shut, they try to do some things that kind of challenge the legitimacy of the trials at various points along the way. I mean, one of those things is that the Katyn massacre, which was a major wartime atrocity, right, that the Soviets had in fact committed, the murder of tens of thousands of Polish officers who were prisoners of war, that had become this political hot potato with the Soviets and the Germans accusing each other of committing the crime. And the Soviets, they think it's like this brilliant idea. They're going to include it in the indictment as a Nazi war crime. And they do this in part because, well, there's so much evidence of other Nazi crimes, right? So they think, who's going to question this? Who's going to challenge this? They do this in part because they don't really understand what the defense case is going to look like, that there's going to be like a full-on defense. They do this in part because the prosecutors have agreed, even before the trials have started, that they're going to keep the tribunal focused on Axis crimes. They actually circulate lists of things that they want to keep out of the courtroom, these taboo lists, and the Soviets put together this list, and other countries do too, right? And so, but what they don't really understand is that the prosecutors might feel this way, but the judges aren't on board with this, right? And the other thing is that once they get Katyn into the indictment as a Nazi crime, they don't think that the defense is going to be able to challenge it. But the defense does challenge it, and the judges allow for the defendants to call witnesses, and they allow the Soviets to call more witnesses on this as well. But that becomes a whole big thing in the Nuremberg courtroom. And there's a lot of anxiety among the British and among the Americans, too, who sort of thought all along that this was a really bad idea to include it in the indictment, but went along with it because Rudenko, the Soviet chief prosecutor, was threatening to have to go back to Moscow and talk to Stalin and delay the whole trial. So they make the compromise and they go along with it. But this hangs over the trial. It hangs over the trial. The other thing, of course, the other big thing that hangs over the trial, again, no one is totally clean hands in all of this, but the Soviets, again, have the most to hide, especially when it came to the secret protocols of the Soviet-German non-aggression pact of August 1939, the non-aggression pact and then the secret protocols sort of led the way for the dual invasion of Poland and the division of Eastern Europe, right? And so that's a crime against peace. So here you have the Soviet jurist who has introduced this idea of a crime against peace, right? And then the Soviets, of course, have a major crime against peace that they're trying to hide. And it just comes out, right, through the course of the trials. And again, because the judges, the Western judges, right, there are four main judges, one from each country of the prosecution, and Nikitchenko, the Soviet judge, he's outvoted again and again and again, so that Ribbentrop and others are able to introduce evidence of this. And this hangs over the trials as well. So the Soviets have contributed in a positive way in terms of the legal framework, in a positive way in terms of some of the evidence that they provide, right? But at the same time, there are these things where everyone is now very anxious about, like, what's going to be exposed and the legitimacy. And you see a fracturing of the countries of the prosecution as time goes on, in part because of the strain of these secrets, and in part because of the Cold War coming into the courtroom as well. So that's part of it as well.
How did Hitler's sexuality shape his worldview? Why did the Black Death lead to the rise of the witch trials? And what are some of the sauciest scandals involving kings and queens at Hampton Court? I don't know about you, but this is the history I want to hear about. If you do too, then join me, Kate Lister, every Tuesday and Friday to find out the answers to all of these questions and more. Listen to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal in society, wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when you use a messaging app, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
You went to the Soviet archives for this.
Yes.
You see, I talk to historians who are much older than you, who remember those halcyon days. You go to the Soviet archives in the 90s and look up all sorts of stuff about Stalin's purges. So how did you get access, and what kind of documents and manuscripts did you see in there?
Yeah, so I did archival research in 2005 and 2006 for the book. And I worked in five Moscow archives, and in archives in other places too. But the Moscow archives were amazing because I was really able to reconstruct the story of the trials in part by looking at the secret documents in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in part by looking at secret documents in the party archive, then and in the state archive, in part by looking at the archive of, in the Ministry of, in the Academy of Sciences that had the legal questions and all the legal back and forth, and in part in the Archive of Literature and Art. And really, this was a moment still in 2005 and 2006, so this is, again, like 15 years ago that I was really doing this research, when the archival access was still pretty good. And although I had to kind of be persistent about getting access to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, it was worth it. And again, it's the documents, the archival documents that not only enable me to tell the story of the Soviet involvement in the trial, but that I think put the whole story of the trial in a different light. Because once you have the Soviet story, then lots of other questions that one might have about like what's really going on behind the scenes, and like questions that the Americans have, like why are the Soviets stalling? Does Rudenko, the Soviet chief prosecutor, really have malaria as they claim? Because when they try to delay the trial, there are all kinds of things that you see what's going on behind the scenes. You're like, oh, okay, so that was what was happening on the Soviet ends of things. Stalin had two secret commissions in Moscow that was operating from afar. Again, they thought this was going to be like open and shut, that they were going to be able to control things. And these secret commissions, I was able to read the transcripts of their meetings. And you see them just wrestling with all of the issues that are coming up in the course of the trials and the Katyn question and the secret protocols and all of this. In looking at correspondence that's sent back by informants, that's the other thing. The Soviets have so many informants. So there's so much information that gets sent back in these just really juicy telegrams and these amazing reports. And you see from, for example, from a telegram that gets sent back from a Soviet diplomat who's acting as an informant in London at the time of the London conference. That's how I learned that the Soviet chief prosecutor, Roman Rudenko, he didn't know about the secret protocols. He didn't know about the what they called in that telegram the secret history of Soviet-German relations. And so the Soviets, you know, they sent him blind, basically, and then they have to make a decision at a certain point about how much to tell him and when, right? So those kinds of documents are just amazing. The other kinds of documents that I really love are these letters, these reports that these journalists are sending back. And again, they're journalists, but they're also informants. And so they're writing these really lengthy letters. And, you know, some of the things they're talking about are Nuremberg's nightlife, right? They're talking about people drinking too much. They're talking about members of the Soviet delegation, right? They're kind of tattling on each other in some ways. But they're also talking about just how painful it is to sit in the courtroom and to have to listen to the testimony day after day after day. The Soviet writer Vasyevo Lodyshnevsky, who is a playwright and a journalist, and he's part of the Soviet delegation of journalists there, he says that one of the other writers, Boris Polovoy, is about to have a nervous breakdown, right? And so all you get this sense of this. And Vishnevsky also is complaining about, you know, the Americans, who he thinks are just not taking this seriously enough. And the thing that really gets him is the American guards who are chewing gum in the courtroom, right? That he's just furious about this. Like, how could this be, like, while they're discussing these horrible atrocities in court? So, again, I think these kinds of documents, they let you get behind the scenes and tell the story of what's going on in the courtroom, but they also enabled me to really tell a more vivid story of the trial and what's happening in the bars and at the private parties and all of that as well.
What effect, if any, did the two approaches, or perhaps more than two, because I'm sure the US, French and British approaches were different as well. What effect did that have on each other, on the various delegations, on the various judges? Was there movement to a kind of a new hybridized form of justice, or did it end up actually repelling? Did this help to deepen the divisions at the end of the war, at the start of the Cold War?
Yeah, no, that's such a great question. And you know, we see that really from the start at the London conference, when the four representatives of the four powers are coming together to work out the details of the charter, and then when they're going to work out the details of the indictment. You know, on a very simple level, you have these different judicial systems, right? Where the US and Britain have the common law system, the French and the Soviets have the civil law system, but the Soviets, of course, have their whole other thing going on with their show trial history too, right? So there's that. But what some of these differences mean is that the indictment, everyone has different ideas about what the indictment should look like, right? For the Soviets and the French, the indictment should include like all of the information, right? And for the Americans and the British, they want to introduce new documents and show things in the course of the trials. And so there's compromises that are made as a result of that. But I think the Soviets didn't really understand, right, what those compromises were going to mean in practice. And so I think that's one of the reasons that they find themselves continually surprised by the new evidence that gets introduced during the course of the trial. They have different ideas, again, about the role that the defense should play. Again, here the Soviets are the odd ones out, because the French go along with the Americans and the British on this. But the Soviets, they are just appalled, first of all, that the defense should be able to have former members of the Nazi party as attorneys, right? That how could that be, right? They're also appalled that the defendants can call witnesses. They think that the prosecution should have veto power over witnesses, and they're not given that veto power, right? They think that how could the defendants be allowed to take the stand in their own defense, right? That's propaganda, the Soviets say, right? And that's shot down as well. So there are lots of these differences in terms of what the trial should look like that that get worked out at the beginning, and the Soviets lose a lot of those battles, which then kind of shapes what they're up against and part of why they're unprepared, right? The other thing, I mean, there's so many interesting things here in terms of what each country wants to get out of the trials, right? All of the countries of the prosecution, all of that, the wartime allies, right? They all want to use the trials in part to tell a story about the war, and they want to shape that story about the war, and they want to shape it in different ways. And, you know, the charter and the indictment, there are different charges, right? The three main class of charges are, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against peace. Crimes against peace being the charge of waging an aggressive war. For the Soviets, crimes against peace, that is the most important charge, right? For the British, it's really important too, but the British are also very interested in prosecuting certain kinds of war crimes, especially crimes at sea. And that's one of the things that they really hold on to. For the French, it's crimes against humanity. What's originally called crimes against civilians and is later defined as crimes against humanity. And all of that factors in as well during the course of the trial in terms of, again, how the indictment is written up and what's presented in court and the kinds of narratives that are told. But I would say that the biggest division of all is really between the Soviet Union and the United States. And that has to do with a lot of things. It has to do in part with Robert H. Jackson, who right from the start, once he comes on board as the U.S. chief prosecutor and travels around Europe, he gets word of Soviet war crimes. He gets word of what the Soviets are still up to in Eastern Europe. And he is just appalled at having to cooperate with the Soviets at all, right? And he does. And all of these compromises are made about Katyn and about all of other things as well. But that just, it really influences things all the way along. And then once the defense case happens in March, which is like coincidentally right also after Churchill gives his Iron Curtain speech in the United States, right? That's at that point, the Soviets, things really take a turn for them in ways that they are not expecting, where lots of evidence about their own war crimes gets introduced into the courtroom. And then the judges consistently allow it.
What is the lasting effect? Just to zoom out a little bit on Nuremberg, you mentioned this kind of historiographical debate, you know, was it this amazing enlightened moment in humanity when we started, invented international law and everything? Or was it just a sordid victor's justice? Where are we on that at the moment, especially given now what we know about the Soviet Union? What is a legacy? What should we think of on this anniversary of Nuremberg?
Oh, that's a hard, yeah, no, it's a really big hard question, right? Because I want to be an optimist about it. And in some ways, I really am. But at the same time, as we see what's happening in the world and we see what's happening with international law and with the ICC, and we're in a moment now where I feel like we go in waves, right, of states being up for that kind of involvement and more concerned or less concerned about state sovereignty and feeling like perhaps they have more to hide or less to hide in terms of things. And I think we're in a moment now where we need to hold on to the legacy of Nuremberg. I think we need to hold on to, and part of that legacy was the Nuremberg principles that came out of the trials. Part of that legacy was the Genocide Convention. Part of that legacy was the Declaration on Human Rights, right? I think those kinds of documents continue to give us hope in trying times because they lay out a way. They lay out a path. They provide a beacon, a kind of a moral compass that I think that as long as people continue to look towards that and to believe in that, that there's still hope, which is why, I mean, I think, you know, one of the dangers, quote unquote, in bringing in the Soviet story about the Nuremberg trials, someone asked me when I began working on this project, are you sure you really want to do this? Like, do you really want to bring in the role of the Soviets and Katyn and, you know, the Soviets' doctored evidence about Katyn, right? So do you really want to talk about that? Like, aren't you like playing into the hands of those who just want to dismiss Nuremberg and international law? And I think we need the full story. I think we need to know the messiness. We need to know the contradictions. We need to know that this wasn't this beautiful time that's been lost, but that things are always complicated. Things are always really messy, right? There are always politics involved. And I think the more that we kind of understand that these are human beings, right, who came to the table. Human beings, in some ways, they agreed with their governments. In other ways, they didn't. Some of them on the Soviet side, you know, who knows? I mean, I used to speculate a lot about Aron Trianon, who introduced these ideas, right? Did he hope in some way that this would change things in his country, right? I don't know. There's no evidence. But, you know, kind of like just when you work on something, you try to get into the heads of the people that you're studying. And I think, again, I think we have to hold on to international law. We have to hold on to these ideals, even as we recognize it's a mess right now. So.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Thank you for giving us some hope, and let's hope we do hold on to them. Fran, your book is called?
Soviet Judgment at Nuremberg, a new history of the International Tribunal after the Second World War.
And it's the anniversary of this year, and your book is out. So thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Hi everyone, it's me, Dan Snow. Just a quick request. It's so annoying and I hate it when other podcasts do this, but now I'm doing it and I hate myself. Please, please go onto iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts, and give us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps, basically boosts up the chart, which is good. And then more people listen, which is nice. So if you could do that, I'd be very grateful. I understand if you don't want to subscribe to my TV channel. I understand if you don't want to buy my calendar, but this is free. Come on, do me a favor. Thanks. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History It. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.